I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, the economy and the role it might play in next week's midterm elections. But first to Iraq. A new report shows the U.S. military doesn't know what happened to thousands of weapons provided to Iraqi security forces. And that's raising questions about whether those weapons may have ended up in the hands of militias. This news comes as today the U.S. military announced its death toll for the month has reached 100, with the death of a Marine in the volatile Anbar province over the weekend. And in the Sadr city section of Baghdad today, a bomb killed more than 30 people. Pam Hess is Pentagon correspondent for UPI. She's been reading the report that's just come out. And Pam, first, how many weapons does this report say are actually missing?
It's a very confusing question, actually. The military bought 370,000 weapons. They've issued about 277,000 to Iraq security forces. That's both the military and their police. These include rocket-propelled grenade launchers, machine guns. Most of them are AK-47s and also 9mm Glock pistols.
Right.
The problem is that the military has not been recording the serial numbers for each of the weapons that are issued, so they can't go back and compare the weapons that they have on hand with the weapons that were issued. The report then also talks about going in and counting the weapons that are on hand with Iraqi security forces and finding more weapons on hand than the military can account for.
Well, so it sounds like what you're saying, there are surprise weapons that nobody expected and they don't know where they came from. But we're reading another number of nearly one of every 25 weapons the military bought for the security forces is missing. That's 14,000 that the Pentagon can't account for.
Right. And the problem is some might have been blown up or burned up when police stations were attacked. Some might have been stolen. Some might be police that took them home for personal protection. Some might have been taken by militias who were people or members of both the police and the militia. It's basically a giant inventory problem. And in Iraq, the last thing you want are extra weapons flowing around. Every household is allowed to have an AK-47, and this just adds to an already chaotic, gun-ridden environment.
Well, remind us how this report came about. We understand it was commissioned by Senator John Warner, chair of the Armed Services Committee. A Republican from Virginia, came back from Iraq with a pretty bleak assessment of the situation there.
Actually, what John Warner was looking for was, why don't the Iraqi forces have spare parts for these weapons? Why don't they have manuals telling them how to repair them? Why don't they have people that know how to repair these weapons if they go wrong? And what the Special Inspector General for Iraq did was look at those questions, plus a larger question, which is, where are all these weapons? Why weren't they recorded somewhere? Why can't we track them by serial number? What they found out on the first part that Warner actually asked about is that they don't, in general, have spare parts for these weapons. They don't have manuals. I think there was one police unit that had a manual for an AK-47 written in Kurdish, and they don't have trained personnel to fix these weapons when they go wrong. That is really indicative of some of the problems that the U.S. military has over there, which is with the ministries of defense and interior. These are not functioning bureaucracies. These are not offices that really track data or track people. They're still having problems within them just getting people on board with the new Iraq and making sure that they are loyal to the Iraqi government and not to some militias.
That's more
of a problem than MOI.
Well, in fact, I do want to ask you about that because, as you mentioned, Special Inspector General Stuart Bowen did prepare more than one report, and in the second report he questioned just how capable the Iraqi Ministry of Interior is prepared to take over the mission. But again, it raised an accounting question. He said that it's impossible to know because we just don't know. There's no oversight of the budgeting. And in fact, he raised a red flag about the Department of Defense as well.
There are big bureaucratic problems in each of these ministries. The Ministry of Defense in Iraq, there's been more than $1 billion that have gone missing that have been associated with corruption. In the Ministry of Interior, there's lots of problems all the way through with sectarian leadership and violence. And the money that comes in, if it's not properly accounted for, the weapons that go in, if they're not properly accounted for, they're just a tempting target for people to take them and use them to their own ends, which then subverts our goal in Iraq, which is a stable, democratic, multi-ethnic government. So all of these little bureaucratic questions that seem sort of tiny and small and even sort of nerdy to be talking about do translate to stability problems in Iraq.
But it would seem that at this point it's a job for the accountant.
It would seem, except for if the data doesn't exist, then the accountants have nothing to crunch and figure out where this stuff has gone. So there's due diligence that has to be done. The early feeling in Iraq on the U.S. side was, let's just get these people weapons, get them standing up and fighting for their country. But now we see what the ramifications are of that on the other end, which is if you just get them weapons, you might be just arming the bad guys. There's no evidence in the SIGA report that says that. There's no evidence that says these weapons have gone to bad guys, but there's also no way of telling that they haven't gone that way. So there is something to be said for the green eye shade bureaucrats that everyone likes to denigrate.
Pam Hess, Pentagon correspondent for UPI. Pam, thanks.
Thank you.
Remember, it's the economy, stupid, the rallying cry of Democrats in the 92 presidential election. Well, what about the economy as voters again head to the poll in a little over a week? The stock market is booming, but the Commerce Department reported today that September saw the smallest consumer spending increase in 10 months. And Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company announced it's cutting 1,100 jobs by closing a plant in Texas. Then there's home sales. Last week, the federal government said new home prices in September fell by the most they have in 35 years, and that doesn't bode well for consumers in the habit of borrowing against their homes to spend money. Despite that, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson told a radio interviewer, "I feel really good about the economy. I really do." Well, does Dr. Alan Sinai? He is founder and chief global economist of the company Decision Economics. He's advised Democrats and Republicans in the White House going back to the 70s, and including the current administration. He joins us now in the studio with a look at the economy. Welcome.
Hi, Robin.
And Henry Paulson, I feel sorry for him because he did sound a little like the Lion and the Wizard of Oz. You know, I do believe in ghosts. I do. Not, you know, almost not convincing. So how do you feel about the economy overall?
You know, basically it's good. Americans are doing well by and large. We do have lately trouble in autos, trouble in housing, home prices coming down, and I think that's the softness we see in the economy. But, you know, this is the fifth year of this expansion going into the sixth year. We have a low unemployment rate. Tremendous number of people have found work and are working. The consumption standard of living has never been higher. It's by and large, it's a pretty good times.
Well, in fact, President Bush would agree. In appearances last week, he said the strong economy would help Republicans. But there seems to be a disconnect because, according to a USA Today poll, 55% of Americans rate the economy is only fair to poor. 54 say it's getting worse. So what are they feeling that perhaps others aren't?
Well, as far as getting worse, I think that is a correct perception because we are slowing down. We have moved to a slower growth rate, and it is being levered by a big slide in housing and residential construction. It's going to go on for a while.
Yeah.
But I think the pessimism that shows up in a lot of the polls on the economy really is dwarfed and overshadowed by how badly Americans feel about the international situation. So that it's kind of getting mucked up.
Do you think it's getting blurred? Do you think people are saying everything's just sort of
I think so. Well, I think Americans are very, very concerned about what's going on internationally. They're concerned about their future and retirement, whether they'll have enough money to take care of that. There are a lot of unsettled and undone national problems that we all know about, and we know nothing much is happening in terms of, and I say this in a nonpartisan way, we know Washington is not doing much about that. And that has systematically kept that disconnect between how the economy is doing and how people feel.
Perceive it.
For quite a long time.
Well, and you know, to in favor of that argument, gas prices have fallen, unemployment is low, the stock market is high. But on the other hand, Paul Krugman, of course, a columnist, today quotes two economists who note that the effective federal tax rate on the richest 0.1% of Americans has fallen from approximately 60% in 1980 to 34% today. But he writes a lot about this buzzword that we seem to be hearing a lot, inequality. And it seems that inequality is a good thing in a market. In other words, the very rich pull along the middle class and the lower class. But he's writing about a rising inequality. He says the money's just not trickling down from the very rich to the middle class.
There is and has been a tendency toward rising wealth and income inequality over the last 4 or 5 years and even beyond that. And that is very pronounced, and it is correct that relatively speaking, there is a great deal more inequality, wealth and income inequality. But I think in absolute terms, everybody in the U.S. economy has done a lot better and is doing better and is living much better than before. Even the tax cuts, for example, everybody got more dollars. But in absolute terms, the rich got more dollars than the quote-unquote poor.
Well,
and the trickle-down effect works through how that money gets invested, and with long lead times, it gets invested in small business and new startups, and shows up. It's hard to say that it hasn't trickled down when so many Americans are working and we have just a 4.6% unemployment rate. That is a relatively and quite low unemployment rate, which says a lot about working America, including the middle class.
Well, and by the way, we should say you favored the Bush administration tax cuts, right? I've got that correct.
The tax cuts, yes. I think they did very well on the tax cuts. We needed the stimulus. You can quarrel with the nitty-gritty of it in terms of rich versus poor, but I think definitely was absolutely the thing to do, the right thing to do.
Well, but you point to the low unemployment rate as you know, sort of proof of that. But people would say, but wait a minute, I may be employed, but I'm working far longer hours. My wages, you know, aren't increasing, and I can't afford health care. My company's cut health care.
The health care for 42 million or so uninsured Americans is a big issue and a big problem. It's one of those national issues that we haven't really grappled with as a nation yet. It is a huge, huge problem. But I think the working more and the strain we all feel is part of the increased productivity of Americans. Being more productive never feels better, but you know what? Those people who are talking about working longer, I believe if they thought about it, would understand that they have more cars, they have more televisions and better televisions, they have more technology around, they have more, they don't have as much leisure time as they'd like to have, but when they travel better, they have more dollars to spend, and they eat out more. That goes hand in hand with working hard. You get more dollars. Wages are rising in inflation-adjusted terms. That's very recent. That's a recent phenomenon. But wages are now on the uptrend for most Americans.
You know, I want to ask you about that spending more. We've got about a minute or so before we're going to take a break with Dr. Alan Sine, again, founder and chief global economist of the company Decision Economics, advisor to many White Houses, including the current one. Both Democrat and Republicans have taken your advice. And you write about Americans spending more. But some have said they're spending money they don't really have. And these are the equity loans they've taken out against huge, you know, hugely priced homes. So is that part of the fear right now that, gee, I've been spending, but I don't really have it. And my plan was to sell this house, and that may not happen.
Consumers are very myopic. They're kind of nearsighted. They don't look too far out. By and large, we have not saved adequately for retirement, and neither the federal government. The federal government isn't going to have the wherewithal to really finance our retirement. Social Security isn't enough, nor are our private sector companies doing it. So that is a definite concern and fear, and one of the reasons people feel uneasy. We need to try to attack that and do something about it as national policy, and nothing much is happening in Washington at this point.
Well, in fact, nothing much is being said about the economy overall. I mean, maybe here and there, especially compared to past election season. So we want to talk to Dr. Alan Sine more about that, about this housing market and where he thinks it's going to go, to the basement, apparently, and beyond. We'll be back with Dr. Alan Sine, again, of the company Decision Economics, advisor to both Democrat and Republican White Houses. Much more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with Dr. Alan Sine, longtime White House advisor on the economy, consulting with both Democrats and Republicans dating back to the 70s, and, of course, also has talked to the current administration. And you were just saying during the break, and I hope this is okay if I say what you said, that, in fact, again, talking about how the mood of the country in general is affecting the way people feel about the economy. The economy's perhaps doing better than people feel it is. And you said that, you know, the irony is that the Bush administration, one of the things that they got right is the economy?
That is the one thing I think they did get right. We were not growing at all. We had low interest rates. We were not having any response to that. Standard medicine is really Keynesian stimulus tax cuts, some increases in government spending, which they did. And I think all of that, timing and otherwise, has been a resounding success. And I think more and more scholars are coming to that conclusion. Now, so why? That
right.
is about the one thing I think they really got right. I think they have not got right, and I'm speaking in a nonpartisan way here, objectively, I think speaking, they have not got right, obviously, the international situation. Americans feel terrible about that. And their initiatives, or other policy initiatives after the last election on retirement, on Social Security and health care, fell flat. and we've had no coherent, sensible plans, real attempts to deal with major problems. We all know we have those problems. Cost of health care, the delivery of health care, how many people get health care, rich versus poor, the inequality issue, and immigration issues, stem cell research, our standing internationally, war in Iraq that we're mired in. Everybody can see it, Republican or Democrat. It's a huge wash list, laundry list of problems to deal with. And Washington, not just the administration, Washington is not dealing with it. And I think we're going to see it in the ballot box very soon,
Well,
believe.
Is this why, I mean, because you wonder if, in fact, many scholars are saying the economy is something the Bush administration got right, why aren't they campaigning more on that? And is it because it reminds people of this laundry list of unfinished business?
You know, I think it's totally just swamped by all the other stuff. They are campaigning on it. They do
just
say
not hearing it
again and again. And I think when people are as concerned as we think they are, as we look at the sentiment surveys, the confidence surveys, the interviews, the Gallup poll, and the kinds of things people are concerned about, the economy doesn't show up at the top of the list. Iraq shows up at the top of the list. Healthcare shows up at the top of the list. And if you go look at Washington and say, are they dealing with it, let alone being a success or a failure? The answer is no, they're not dealing with it. Do they have a mindset to deal with it? And the impression given is we got a stubborn crew in Washington, both in Congress and in the administration, that isn't flexible enough to really go after these problems. That is very discouraging, I think, if you're an ordinary citizen. And in this set of comments, think of me as an ordinary citizen, independent politically, not as an economist.
Well, I want to put your economist hat back on and talk to us about one of the big bad headlines that is frightening people. And you know, I'm wondering if there's anything a White House can do. It's the housing market. Paul Krugman, again, writes in today's New York Times, we're in stage four of the five stages of housing grief, and they include denial. And he says this is so important, and we do know this, because most of the good economic news has been because of the high home prices. Consumers, again, borrowing against these highly priced homes, spending the money, fueling the economy. And now there's huge fear of doing that and foreclosures and people realizing they can't pay their mortgages and can't sell their homes for the price they planned on selling it for. How bad is it going to get?
Well, it's a very bad housing and residential construction recession, and I think the second shoe is now dropping, which are those price declines. And we will see less spending because of the price declines on an asset that we've all borrowed against and that has been used by lenders as collateral. The collateral is going to erode. Now, it is going to erode. The price is going to come down from incredible highs. So for most families, it's just a paper loss and not a big deal. But for those who got in the housing boom late and bought or speculated, and the lenders that did these, marginal loans, there's going to be damage. And I'm not sure it's the bulk of American families look fairly secure in terms of their leverage in housing, in terms of the resetting of mortgages. I think we'll get through it, but not without a period of much slower growth in the economy
of
it.
You mentioned the marginal lenders, and do you think, as others like Paul Krugman do you think that this is something the Bush administration could have done more about and should do more about, which is the lending practices?
No, I actually don't think so. I think I put on the hat of a central banker here, and those who take a chance and try to speculate in the housing boom and the builders who build in advance of price increases, the buyers who buy because they think prices will go up, those who borrow 90 or 100% of their home loans so they can go and spend the money rather than consolidate loans to do something productive with it. I think part of the business cycle is flushing that out. It sounds tough. It sounds mean. It sounds hard. But if I think of it from the point of view of a central banker, the excesses of the housing boom, the bubble-like stuff that went on, really has to get flushed out, and taken care of. I think the bulk of Americans will not be damaged in a big way by what is going on.
So one last question for you. Can we get a little over a minute? We are, you know, talking about this because we're in a political time, an election season. What do you make of the recent polls that show Republicans ahead on terrorism and immigration, but Democrats ahead of Republicans on everything, including the economy, a real turnaround for Democrats? Are they crafting a better message? I mean, because you've been saying that the Republicans actually have crafted a good economy. So how do you...
What the Republicans got right were the tax cuts that stimulated the economy that was hardly growing and picked it up and got us going on recovery and some jobs creation and a lower unemployment rate and helped the rest of the world economies. I don't think, got right, nor did we do anything about health care and all of the rest of the problems that we've mentioned. So it is not at all surprising that in the midst of all of this concern about the future, that the Democrats, on the hope that they'll come forward with better programs, get better marks. Not surprised by that at all. It's a political reaction. Not at all surprised. Our history is filled with these kinds of examples. When they screw up on a big issue, which is the international, it hurts everything
That's
else.
Where you see trickle down. Dr. Alan Sinai, founder and chief global economist of the company Decision Economics, an advisor to Democrats, Republicans, and the current White House. Dr. Sinai, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thanks, Robin. It's a pleasure.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Republican Senator Rick Santorum of Pennsylvania is in a fierce re-election battle. His opponent, State Treasurer Bob Casey, is ahead in the polls, 54-38%. So Santorum did what many Republican candidates in trouble are doing. He called the White House for help, not from the president, but from the president's wife, Laura. The First Lady has become the Republican Party's biggest weapon on the campaign trail. Today, she rallied for Santorum in Pittsburgh before heading to New Hampshire. Joining us to talk about Laura Bush's growing influence on the campaign trail, we first turned to New York Times political correspondent Jeff Zeleny. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you.
Laura Bush once a very reluctant campaigner, right?
She was, but that was back in 99 when her husband first started running for president. It was sort of a running joke on the campaign trail.
Well, in fact, the story is passed around that she agreed to her husband's marriage proposal as long as he agreed she didn't ever have to give speeches. But as you say, she does give them, and beautifully. Is that part of the appeal, that she can say, I really don't like this, and yet do it aggressively?
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, she can go out and portray herself as an average person, a real person who's connected to their concerns and their values, and she's a non-threatening face of the White House, and that is exactly what Republicans are looking for.
This election cycle, she's appeared at more than 30 political events, raised more than $12 million. It seems as if she goes to some of the campaigns where, in fact, the president's negative polling numbers might not help.
Exactly, and one example of this is Rochester, New York. In the past week and a half, she has gone in two times for Representative Tom Reynolds. He is the head of the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee, but he is suddenly in a tough race of his own. He certainly had his fortunes complicated by the whole Mark Foley scandal. So Mrs. Bush has gone in about a week and a half ago and again on Saturday to campaign with him. And her presence at his side is designed to send the message that she's okay with him. And one of the people they're hoping to reach is women voters.
Laura Bush has a terrific appeal. We're going to talk more about that with a Republican analyst in just a moment. But she has disagreed with her husband publicly, publicly said she doesn't think same-sex marriage should be a campaign issue, for instance.
She has disagreed with him, usually in quiet manners, but that is part of her appeal as well. People see her as a genuine person, as a legitimate person, and she can have a disagreement with her spouse, who happens to be the president. But she is not out there campaigning on what they disagree about. Those are few and far between. In fact, right after September 11th, when President Bush was saying, we have to get Osama bin Laden, he's wanted dead or alive, she encouraged him to stop that rhetoric. She told him he sounded like a cowboy, but at the same time, that's what, you know, White House focus groups were saying people thought of him. So she is sort of used as an everyman and woman's barometer, if you will.
I'm thinking of another instance when a version of the American anthem was produced in Spanish and the president said he thought the anthem should be in English. She said, well, I think people should be allowed to sing it in Spanish.
Exactly. It sort of allows the White House to have it both ways, if you will. Her point of view is definitely very supportive, very Republican in its principle, but she believes and espouses a big tent philosophy, so it allows a different kind of a message to come through. But if you spent any time with Mrs. Bush on the campaign trail at all, I remember flying around with her in the 2004 campaign. She is immensely popular. She goes from place to place in a very non-threatening way, And she does tons of press that we don't even know, realize, you know, she's doing like a lot of radio programs and magazine interviews and other things. So she is very much a star in this campaign, as she has been in previous ones.
Championing issues like literacy, education, combating HIV, the rights of women.
Although she is a champion for all these issues, she doesn't talk about those a lot when she's campaigning for Republican candidates. She's there for one purpose, and it's to create a media buzz in these local communities, which it absolutely does. She's there to do interviews with the local reporters. She's there to appear at the side of candidates. So she is very non-controversial.
Jeff, can you think of any time when First Lady Laura Bush made a misstep?
I can't think of any time, actually, and that's pretty extraordinary, really. She is, by and large, a very savvy political operative in her own right, but she has said that she will never run for office, and I think she's very much looking forward to the end of all this once 2008 comes.
Jeff Zeleny, political correspondent for The New York Times. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, for a little more on the impact Laura Bush has on the campaign trail, one who's been there with her, Republican analyst Jim Nuzzo, joins us now in the studio. Jim, welcome as always.
Good to see you.
And you've been in a room with Laura Bush. What's it like?
You know, she is the anti-politician, and that comes across. It comes across as a real person who doesn't really want to be there, but is there because it's so incredibly important. And that authenticity radiates out of the room. She's also has this very sort of girl-next-door beauty that sort of shines forth as well.
Frankly, we've been speaking of her skin. Mm-hmm. There's something luminescent about her face.
Right.
And how do people react to her? What do they want to talk to her about?
Again, I think they sort of understand that this is a woman of substance. This is a woman who has stood by her man, in the Tammy Wynette phrase.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because her predecessor, Hillary Clinton,
right,
famously said she's not someone who's just stand by her man, sit home and bake cookies.
Right.
But Laura Bush also told a Chicago paper in 2004, I don't bake cookies.
Well, she may not bake cookies, but she saved her husband literally. I mean, she was the one who basically said to him when he had the horrible drinking problem in the early 90s, look, you got to get help or I'm out of here with the girls. And it was that strong sort of statement to him that with Billy Graham's intervention was allowing him to turn his life around. I mean, he will tell you if you talk to him that she is the reason why he is probably alive today.
So she has this sort of literal woman behind the man, mm-hmm, reputation with the court, with the base.
Not only was just with the base. I mean, I think that much like Barbara Bush, she is someone who is seen to have this very soft exterior, but a steel rod. The dirty little secret among Republicans regarding the Bushes is that the men are actually quite soft, but that the hard, the tough ones who you don't cross are the women.
You know, it's interesting. As she travels today up to New Hampshire, I'm thinking that parts of the country may know her well and, mm-hmm, see her often, and parts, for instance, Massachusetts, where we are,
right,
we don't see Laura Bush that much. It's a pretty blue state, mm-hmm, and, you know, we just don't know her as well as maybe other parts.
No, I mean, look, we're so blue that Yale ought to be here and Harvard in Texas, I think. The bottom line is, she doesn't have an awful lot of time to campaign. She doesn't like it an awful lot. And so, therefore, she needs to make certain that those places that she does visit are places that are going to help her husband and the issues that she cares about.
Quick question. Being a former Republican consultant, now, mm-hmm, analyst, we understand that for the speech in New Hampshire that Laura Bush is giving today, for the appearance there, in order to get a much coveted ticket, you have to volunteer to answer the phone banks up there.
Right.
Republican strategists at work.
Well, absolutely. I mean, look, the GOTV, the get out the vote, the 72 hours that come around election time can be worth 2-3 points in an election. An awful lot of these elections, both in New Hampshire and elsewhere, could be very tight. 2-3% could make the difference one way or another. Republicans are counting on a 72-hour push at the end. It's what made it for them in 2004. It's what Karl Rove thinks is going to do it for them in 2006.
Jim Nuzzo, Republican analyst, thanks so much for speaking with us today about First Lady Laura Bush.
It was great to be here.
And you're listening to Here and Now. And now, as we head to Halloween, scaring the wits out of adults. Theater producer Timothy Haskell and a team of designers polled New Yorkers to find out their greatest fears and then built scary rooms to prey on those fears. The result, Nightmare, Face Your Fear, 13 haunted houses scattered around the five boroughs of New York City, with walls covered with dead cockroaches, people forced to eat icky things. That's actually called cytophobia. In one house, one member of the tour is removed and bad things happen, and that one confronts the fear of losing loved ones. Well, Nightmare producer Tim Haskell joins us now on a very shaky cell phone as he works in these houses. Tim, first of all, what are some of the generic fears most New Yorkers have?
Rats, roaches, being someone breaking into your house, clowns, drowning.
Well, how did you address, for instance, and again, these are haunted houses for adults, so how do you address the fear of rats, for instance? And what's the name of that, by the way?
It is musophobia, which sort of takes care of all rodents. And it's a sensory hallway. It's completely dark, and there are elements of rat, including a rat smell, that evoke rats. Things like rat tails that graze by your feet, a wall that feels like a rat scurrying back and forth, squeaky floors and air cannons that feel like a rat jumped out again, things like that, just completely sensory.
Ugh. By the way, you're in the middle of, putting the finishing touches on all of these houses right now, so we've caught you on the fly and we appreciate it. But we found it interesting that Howdy Doody came up for frightening many people in Brooklyn.
Well, it was more the fear of dolls, and I got Howdy Doody as an answer. People are generally afraid of dolls or mannequins or marionettes, and I actually, one of the funnier answers I got more than once was Howdy Doody himself.
Who knew, by the way, there's a name for this, pediophobia, or fear of the false representation of sentient beings. How do you represent that?
We just line the walls with them as you're walking through, and then you walk down a corridor full of mannequins, and they start lunging at you.
Oh, these sound horrible, and yet I know they're inspired because you did one on the Lower East Side for Manhattanites last year, and you had hundreds of people who couldn't make it inside. Why? I mean, why would a New Yorker, for instance, want to see in your Brooklyn haunted house a woman forced to eat her own intestines?
I think for the same reason why they like to go and see horror movies. There's something thrilling about it. It's, I guess, the same reason why you jump out an airplane or do bungee jumping or do whitewater rafting. I think there's a thrill of doing something that is typically very scary, an adrenaline rush that gets you through it. And I also think that people, deep down inside really like a good scream, just like a good cry or a good laugh. I think a good scream is therapeutic. And then I think guys like to take their girls because they like their girls to jump on.
And by the way, that poor woman, she's not really eating her own intestines.
No, she is. We get a different actress every 4 minutes.
Tim, I have to just tell us what you did for what some say is one of the biggest fears of Manhattanites, which is the fear of heights. We understand one idea that you had was to have people walk up the stairs onto a plexiglass floor and see teeny tiny furniture beneath them so they'd think they were high up.
We're trying to create some depth perception, but we realized that having people walk across a plexiglass floor, 10 feet above, probably had some liability issues.
Well, Tim, I'm just wondering, on the more serious side, here you are, this is Manhattan and the boroughs, this is, just years after 9/11. Is a part of it, New Yorkers saying, I got to face my fears because who knows what can happen?
Some people actually get some therapeutic quality out of it. Some people will actually say, I went because I'm afraid of rats, or I went because I'm afraid of everything. But face it, I guess it's a level of psychoanalysis where you actually face your fears in that way. That's not necessarily our MO, but I know that people have engaged in that way. Mm.
Timothy Haskell, creator and director of Nightmare, Face Your Fear, 13 haunted houses in the New York area. The houses close on November 2nd, so to find out more about schedules and tickets, visit our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Running a marathon can be dangerous. Yesterday at the Marine Corps Marathon from Arlington, Virginia to Washington, D.C., two runners suffered heart attacks. One of them, Earl Seaford of Olney, Maryland, died. But despite those risks, California Dean Canassus is trying to run 50 marathons in 50 states in 50 days. Today is day 44 of his quest, and he plans to finish up at the New York City Marathon this Sunday. How's he doing? Well, we'll find out in a minute. But first, why is he doing this? As Dean writes in his book, Ultramarathon Man, Confessions of an All-Night Runner, he's made a habit of taking running to the extreme. He's been known to run 75 hours without stopping. He eats whole pizzas and cheesecakes without breaking his stride. Here and our producer, Karen Miller-Metzen, spoke with Dean when he visited Boston recently. But first, she had to put on her running shoes.
And the bass keeps running, running, and 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 running, running, and
we're running down Dartmouth Street right now. So far, we're not out of breath.
Starting slow. We'll pick it up later on.
What's an average daily run for you?
20 is good. 25 is better, but I usually do between 15 and 20 a day. I do between 100 and maybe 110 typically in a week.
Four marathons?
Yeah, about four marathons, yeah.
Dodging Boston taxis here.
New experience, yeah.
So I bet you can't find too many training partners who are going to run, you know, 110 miles a week with you at 4 in the morning.
No, periodically people join me along the way, but usually they don't go the whole way. Or they'll ride a bike. A lot of times.
It's probably what I should have done. I know you ran in high school and then you didn't run for a number of years. So tell me about how this all got started again.
Well, I was in a bar on my 30th birthday, and at about 11 o'clock at night, I don't know, I just had this, I call it a midlife crisis. A lot of people say 30's too young to have a midlife crisis, but I think that's what I had. And decided that I wanted to start running again. So I walked out of the bar, walked back to my house. I lived around the corner, stripped down to my jockey briefs, started running south, and decided I want to try and run 30 miles on my 30th birthday.
So you ran through the night in your underwear, wearing black silk socks, if I remember from your book. Got there, you couldn't move, and you decided this is something I want to do more of?
It was a good hurt, yeah.
Tell me about the time you ran a marathon in the South Pole.
I was lucky to be alive after that one. It was minus 40 degrees, and I ran with a face mask in front of me, goggles, all of which froze solid. The conditions changed a lot. I mean, I'm about a 2:30 marathoner, and I was running as hard as I could, and it took me 9 hours and 18 minutes. So in those 9 hours, it went from just sheer white opaque, where you literally were getting vertigo. I mean, you couldn't tell if you were running upside down or backwards. I mean, it's completely white. And then there's other times of crystal clarity where you could see for miles and miles.
And the bass keeps running, running, and running, running, and running, running.
After 5 or 6 miles of running, Dean agreed, finally, to let me stop. We sat down in the lobby of the downtown Boston hotel where he was staying, and I noticed he's not even sweating. That's when I asked him what it felt like to run his first 50-mile run, which was a qualifying race for his first 100-mile run.
Well, the race went okay. I qualified, but the finish was a little bit unanticipated in that once I got back inside my car, I got violently ill and got trapped in my car. And crawled out and fell down onto the dirt, and that's how it ended up. But it was still a very proud moment for me because I qualified for the Western States 100.
So you were violently ill, cramped, couldn't move, trapped in your car because your arms were virtually paralyzed, and you were then planning on running 100 miles.
I like pain, I guess.
Tell me about your first 100-mile run.
Well, it was really an exploration into the unknown is what I liked. I mean, I wasn't sure how I would fare. Once I hit 50 miles, everything beyond that was new territory. It got worse and worse, and I kept thinking, it can't get any worse than this, and something worse would happen. My toenails would fall off, or I'd go blind, and Kept struggling, and finally got to a point at mile 99 where I was crawling on all fours. I was reduced to something less than human, and then I rejuvenated and finished the race, and it was probably the most inspirational thing I've ever done.
So that was your first 100-mile run, but you've done longer than 100-mile runs.
Yeah, I kept seeing if I could expand, the envelope of human endurance. It intrigues me to see how far the body can be pushed, and yeah, after 100, it was 135. Across Death Valley in the summer. And that's about the longest organized solo running event. So I started entering relay races, so these 12-person relay races that were 199 miles long. And I didn't have 11 friends left at this point, so I did them by myself.
Tell me about some of the unusual things that happened to you on longer runs. I read in your book that you once fell asleep on the road.
Well, the first time it happened, I wasn't really sure what had gone on. I woke up, and I was in the middle of the road running. And I thought, how did I get here? So I meandered back over to the shoulder, and then I heard a loud horn blasting, and I woke up again. I realized I was sleep running, and I didn't fall over. I just kept running for hundreds of feet, and I'd run right out in the middle of a road, and a car was barreling down toward me. So that's problematic.
Tell me about some of the medical problems that come along with this. People wonder, I wonder, is this okay for your body?
I've had my blood work done post and pre-race, and pre-race everything's normal. Post, it's out of whack. What I found is that things typically after 2 weeks are back to normal. So I don't feel like I'm doing any long-term damage. If I did, I wouldn't be doing it.
I mean, the things you do seem extraordinary to most people. Are they things that you feel that other people could do if they tried, or is there something about your build or your genetics that make you able to do it, whereas other people probably couldn't?
I think that's a good question. I think it's a combination of things. I've got good alignment, as they say, so I don't pronate or supinate, and my foot strike is really true, and my heel hits and rolls kind of perfectly. I do have good endurance. I mean, if you look at my resting heart rate, it's around 40. Maybe there's some genetic things there. But I think a lot of running these long races is mental. I mean, they say, for instance, with the Western States 100, you run the first 50 with your legs and the next 50 with your mind.
That's Dean Karnazes, author of Ultramarathon Man, Confessions of an All-Night Runner, speaking to Here and Now's Karen Miller-Metzen recently. Well, as we said, Dean's now on a mission to run 50 marathons in 50 days. He just finished run number 44. That was in Kiawah, South Carolina. He's doing well, according to his trainer, Jason Koop.
Yeah, he's doing both mentally and physically fine. I mean, he's obviously run 44 marathons in a row, so he's got his fair share of bumps and bruises. His legs are fine. His legs actually feel really good. All of his joints feel really good. He's just a little banged up from the fall that he took a few days ago. But he's doing fine. He's looking forward to the finish in New York City.
Woo-hoo! Yeah!
I guess so. That's Jason Koop of Carmichael Training Systems. Of course, he didn't mention that Dean now weighs 7 pounds. That's not true. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.